Good morning. Welcome to the Senate Health and Human Services Committee, Friday, March 18th. We were anticipating taking 703 first, but we had an amendment to that that got miscopied, and it's going to take 10 minutes or so to get the copies redistributed. So we're going to go ahead and take up the second part of our agenda, Senate File 578, which is a Senator Benson bill, who is... I don't know if she's actually had the baby yet, or she's, we're not sure. Maybe we can get an update from Senator Sharon. But Senator Sharon has agreed to present the bill on behalf of Senator Benson. Thank you for doing that, and thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I'm happy to announce that I'm here at the request of Senator Benson to present this bill for her this morning because she's not able to be here. As a matter of fact, she is celebrating with Claire Ann.
All right, very good.
Baby girl. And she was born at 2 a.m. this morning.
Wow.
And she was thinking about coming.
I was going to say, where is Senator Benson? I mean, that was 2 o'clock. It's now 8:30. I mean,
she was the excuse.
She has time. She had time. She
By the way, members, and I do want to announce we do have a quorum.
Wait. I'll invite my testifiers to the table. I'm happy to be here for Senator Benson to introduce her legislation, Senate File 578. This bill, I have an oral amendment unless the department is here because I thought they were going to come and ask for an amendment, but if they're not, will someone remind me that I need to make an amendment? Oh, they are here. Okay. Never mind. This piece of legislation is a request for proposals for a combined online application. Now, I know many of you here know that the issue of simplification of the process of applying for public programs has been on our agenda for a very long time. I understand there's been a settlement and a lawsuit with a company that we have spent a lot of money with in order to create an online simplification process in our public programs. This is another... and a series of steps that are being taken by many people interested in a simplification process. I know that Senator Hahn has a bill on simplification. I have another bill that also deals with simplification in which this fits very well. But today, the bill that we're presenting is about implementation of an online application and eligibility determination process, which will simplify and expedite eligibility determinations. We did launch Healthcare Link in Minneapolis, and this site focuses on healthcare eligibility and access for low-income individuals. This site will include a link to online application once it's completed. The specifics of the proposal will be described to you by the testifiers. You have with you a piece of information. It looks like this, the self-service outcomes. Senator Benson wanted you to have this. It's to take a look at what the possibilities are, the outcomes that you can count on for self-service, where a person approaches and self-serves on the front end of the process for determining their eligibility for public programs. And that's very important to Senator Benson that what we do is able to demonstrate value and outcome for our investment. We can talk a little more about the financing of this after you get just an overview of what the idea is and how it is possible now to streamline eligibility determination. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over. Would Mr. Dahl like to begin?
Sure.
To Steve Dahl, who is the director of Deloitte Consulting Midwest Public Sector Practice. And I just want you to know that there is a group of us who are studying and looking at what other states are doing, what we might do in this state to do simplification. And we had a full presentation of what the possibilities were during that meeting. I wish you could all see this, because I'm a person that has to sort of see it to get it. So I'm hoping that the verbal description is helpful to you.
Senator Sharon, before we take Mr. Dahl's testimony, you mentioned that there was an amendment. Did you have an author's amendment you wanted to make?
The Department of Human Services reviewed the bill, The department would like to explain what it is they'd like to have changed in the bill. Would that be acceptable to you?
Sure. And so why don't we do that before we take the testimony, just to get the bill in the order that you'd like to see it?
Mr. Chair, members, Shannon Kojisoy, Department of Human Services. And we just requested a date change. So we'd like to amend the date. I believe it's currently October 1st, 2011.
Yes.
And we would like to amend that date. I believe Senator Benson requested January 31st, 2012. And the reason for that amendment is just to allow us more time to develop the RFP, issue the RFP, allow vendors to respond, and then choose and negotiate contracts and final negotiations with the those vendors.
Okay. Members, we'll treat this as an author's amendment, changing the date October 1, 2011 to January 31, 2012 on line 1.22. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Thank you. Senator Sharon, do you now want to hear from Mr. Dahl?
Okay, so we will begin then to talk about this online application process. What I would like the committee to understand is that the application process itself, which will be self-directed, will not determine eligibility. It's not about determining eligibility. It will be to provide the caseworker the necessary information to start processing the case. So once the application is completed, it will be sent electronically to the county, to the state, or a tribe that will then process the case. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Dahl.
Great,
Mr. Dahl.
Thank you. Steve Dahl out of Twin Cities here in Minnesota, and thanks for the opportunity to talk with you here today. I speak in favor of the
Mr. Dahl, could you just identify your who you are, who you represent?
Yep. Steve Dahl with Deloitte Consulting out of here in the Twin Cities, Minnesota. We've helped more than 10 states transform the eligibility process for Health and Human Services systems over the last many years, really looking at how do we simplify a process, standardize where possible and practical, and put the eligibility process online. And this really represents a true reform. It's really an opportunity to open a new channel to provide service, better service at lower cost, puts us available 24/7, helps people avoid long lines and be able to work either from and do their initial work either from home or from a partner, not-for-profit partner site where they get help, or they can still go through the traditional channels if they so choose. But it also provides an opportunity for individuals to get an understanding before they go through the full process of what they're truly eligible for. So they can complete an initial review online and determine, am I eligible for some benefits or not? And that opens the door for them to also look at other programs that they may be eligible for that they were not aware of. So it can get them the full set of services and leg up that they're looking for and the state is looking to provide to help individuals. But also then they determine if they're not eligible, and then they won't go through the full process and invest a lot of their time, but also a lot of the time of the county workers and the others within the process, which can provide for significant work savings through the process by having this available online. And really, it also provides it for one set of data entry. If they do the initial review and the application online, that data is then transferred into the back office caseworker system. So the data is already entered in. The caseworkers don't have to spend a lot of time doing that data entry, and they can actually focus their efforts on social work versus on administrative processes. So examples of some of the capabilities are typically put in the self-service option that we've helped people like Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Florida, Michigan, others with are, am I eligible? So this is that initial review that can be done online, the ability to apply, do an initial application online, the ability for individuals to report changes, basic changes in their life online that may impact eligibility, to check their benefits and understand where those are, and then to be able to work with provider and partner networks to do this. So it's provided a significant opportunity for savings and quality improvement at the same time for the states that we've worked with. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Dahl? Senator Sharon, did you want to continue?
Thank you. So you can see that if this bill isn't enacted, it really would effectively help streamline the process when you're applying for the various programs for public assistance, reduce staff and administrative costs, which is a goal we've all had for a very long time, provide applicants with a discrete experience in examining whether or not they're eligible for these programs, which is going to reduce any kind of stigmatization that they might experience. And it would give them enough information to determine their likely eligibility while asking them only for the information that they need for the program. Senator Benson was going to tell you a story of her experience when she first got elected. I understand she went in to try to fill out and complete an application, and it took her somewhere in the range of 4 hours to weed through the process, and she is an accountant.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Sharon, how does this differ from what the department is working on already?
Senator Sharon.
The department has some federal grant, and they're in the middle of doing something similar to this. I don't know what the differences are.
Senator
Hand, I do have a report from the Department of Human Services on the various efforts that they're engaged in. And if it would be okay with you, I would invite them to come to the table to talk about that and that what they see is the relationship here.
Sure. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Troy Mangan from the Department of Human Services. There's two, I think, separate issues here. One is that we have in process the development of an online application, a smart online application for healthcare, cash, food support, and child care assistance that was funded by the 2009 legislature. We're also using state health access program grants from the feds to fund that as well, and that's a smart online application that would do some of what's being asked here in terms of providing a better application experience. And again, we're going to be piloting that next month and rolling that out later this year. So that effort's going on. It doesn't have the interaction with the major systems in terms of putting that information into MAXIS and MMIS in the way that I understand this proposal is looking at. The other thing that we have is that we did present a budget page earlier this year for a leveraging some of the federal systems funding, the 90% funding that the CMS has proposed to offer. We did put together a budget page for the design, development, and installation of a streamlined eligibility determination system, and that was, as you remember, about $2.5 million in state funding, which gives about $25 million over the biennium for the development of a system. Now, the relationship between these, this kind of the depth of this versus the depth of this of this proposal, I'm not sure about in terms of how much we're talking about just in self-service front end versus actual changes to MAXIS and MMIS, so it would enable workers to be able to process those cases more efficiently beyond just putting that information into the system, and that's I'm not as clear about that. But yes, we do have something going on in terms of a smart application for those for all those programs, and that will be rolled out this year.
So, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, so my concern with this bill is that we not start over, because I've been here a while and we've been working on this for like 12 years or so. And I would hate for us to quit doing what we've done so far to get this far. And so my concern is somehow to get the wording of this bill in such a way that it picks up where this project that's going to start this spring leaves off and, you know, develops it further rather than starting over again, Mr. Chairman. I don't know how to do that. Maybe the department can offer some advice.
Are there concerns about the issue that Senator Berglund is raising, or can these things work together, or what's the view of the department?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, I think that in looking at this language before, we think that that it's broad enough for us to be able to construct a request for proposals that would build off of what we're doing now. There's certainly more things that we would like to do with the online application as we have now, especially adding sort of individual things around an individual account and enhancing that capability. We don't have at this point a screening tool built into this, and we've had some discussions with the folks at Children's Defense Fund about how can we look at maybe using Bridge to Benefits for this. So I think that the language here would not constrain us from building on what we've done now and adding to that. The principles in this bill are broad enough that I think it gives us the mm-hmm. flexibility to be able to do that. And we certainly would not want to start over again. We've invested a lot of time and have a very nice online application right now, and we'd really want to build off of that.
Senator Berglund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it was important to have that on the record.
I agree. I guess to that point, as long as you're here, I just want to ask one question on line 1.21. We say, based on responses to the RFP, the commissioner shall enter into a contract for services. Whenever we say that you know, this is pretty directive, not a whole lot of wiggle room, is that what we want to say, or do we want to try to provide for the possibility, I suppose, that the RFPs may not be exactly what we need, and if we say you have to do it anyway, but I'm not sure how we would write the language to accommodate that, to give you some spot. But is there a concern on the part of the department for that language, and if so, is there a way to word that? That would
Mr.
be better?
Chair, I'm embarrassed to say that until you mentioned that, I hadn't really thought through that scenario. But yes, I think, I mean, the worst case scenario would be that we would spend a lot of time developing a request for proposal, get proposals in, and just none of them would work, or we would not be able to enter into a contract under the funds that we have allowed. So that's certainly a concern. I don't know whether the legislation here would necessarily constrain us to, yes, you have to contract despite the folks not meeting the terms. Generally, we say in the RFP, in there, we can withdraw it at any time. We always reserve the right to not actually end up contracting with somebody. So I think our RFP and contractual procedures would cover this. You could make it May, but I think we're fine with saying we have mechanisms to say we're not going to go forward, and we'd certainly report back to you if that did happen. We hope it doesn't, but as far as I know I think we're okay as far as that goes.
And I was going to ask counsel, is that your understanding that if we're okay with this language, and it would still give the department room to not accept a proposal if it really was not workable or out of the bounds of the cost framework?
Mr. Chair, yes, but just to be safe, you may want to change the shall to a may and then add some language that says if the department does not enter into a contract, you're required to report back to the legislature on the next steps. I can clean that up a little.
Senator Hinn.
Senator Sherrin.
I know that Senator Benson would really not like to see shall removed from this legislation. If there was anything that was made clear to me, it was that. So, but I do think that moving the date, which is the motion that the department is asked to January 31st, 2011, allows us to be in session and allows for us to have the opportunity to have the department come back and ask us to take an action to change the date or to delay the date should they not be able to meet it at that time. And it might be, if we needed comfort language, I'd prefer to see it in that paragraph rather than eliminated from the parameter that I think Senator Benson wanted to communicate to you, that she really felt that we've been struggling for a long period of time without any kind of completion
progress
of the project. And so we have some achievements, but it's been going on. We've spent a ton of money So I just want to communicate as best I can what Senator Benson's intent was.
And I understand, and I maybe what, given the change in the date, we could provide some language require a report back to the legislature on the status of the contract that has been agreed to or is being contemplated being agreed to before it's actually implemented, so that if there are issues, I'm not sure how we would do that, but I appreciate the desire of the author of the bill.
Mr. Chair, I have a suggestion.
I do have a couple other folks, but yes, Senator Berglund had a question, and then Senator.
My question is, there is no fiscal note in our packet, so is the fiscal note the same as the governor's budget page?
Senator Sheridan. Senator Sheridan.
Senator Hahn, I do not have a fiscal note either, although my understanding is that there was a fiscal note in the House.
No.
So is the fiscal note the same as the governor's budget request page?
Excuse me, Senator.
Senator Sheridan, go ahead.
Would you repeat that?
Is the fiscal note the same as the governor's budget request on the budget book?
Senator Sheridan.
For this
there
area?
Was not a request apparently for a fiscal note for this bill.
Okay.
Well, then, Mr. Chairman, does the department have the money to implement this without any additional money?
Senator Hahn.
Senator Sheridan,
I think the department can talk with this, but I can tell you that when the House heard the bill, what they discussed was that there was federal money available, matching money in the range of 70% to 90% in order to support this kind of process, and that the remaining amount would be fronted by whoever the part of the contract would be, that the company would front the costs of the project and be paid back on demonstrated savings that are promised by those that are you know, presenting to us and saying that these investments do create cost savings.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, maybe someone from the department can tell me if that's allowed under federal law. I mean, you have to have a federal match. If you're getting a federal match, you have to have a state share up front. And I'm not sure if the federal government allows us to make our match by taking private money and then promising to pay it back later.
Please.
Mr. Chair, members, Shannon Kojisoy, the Department of Human Services. We actually haven't received a fiscal note request on this in the Senate bill or the House bill. So I think we would like to look at this and analyze it for a fiscal impact, but we have not had that request made. In the House, it was just heard in the policy committee, so we did discuss it for the policy of the bill, but we have not discussed the fiscal implications yet.
Perhaps then we can provide us with some sort of fiscal note on this, and as we look at putting together our bill next week, you can provide that to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members, we can do that definitely by early next week.
Our intent would be to lay this over to consider it, and based on what the fiscal note says, we could perhaps make a decision on that as we take it up. Senator Higgins, did you have a...
Mr. Chair, back to the shall may issue. If you look on line 21, I have a proposed change in the language that may help us. So delete based on, insert if. After the word proposals, insert meet the requirements in paragraph A. So it would be, if responses to the RFP meet the requirements in paragraph A, the commissioner shall issue.
Any thoughts from our council? Does that
Mr.
work?
Mr. Chair, yes, that sounds fine, but then if they don't enter into a contract, it doesn't require the department to come back and, you know, explain why. I don't know if you want that language, too.
I would imagine that the author would like to have, if something isn't going to happen, to have some report back. So maybe we could add to the a line after that some request for a report in the event that they can't or feel they can't enter into the contract. Could we get some language on that? I know Senator Higgins, my experience in the past is that you're very good at these word things, and I appreciate your your attention to that. Thank you.
I have another one on line 15.
Go ahead.
As long as I'm on a roll.
Say, go ahead. Sorry.
There's this really stuffy "such that the applicant" section of this line. So I would propose deleting the word "such" after the word "that," insert "asks," delete "will be asked." So in a manner that asks the applicant only those questions that relate to.
All right.
And I'll offer that. It's
right.
Just cleanup.
Okay. Members, I'm going to take that as a motion amendment, oral amendment on line 1.15, delete "such" and replace with "asks," and then...
Delete "asks" comes after that.
Sorry. Delete "such," insert "asks" after "that." And then further in that same line, delete "will be asked." That's one part of the oral amendment. The other part is on line 1.21, delete "based on," replace that with "if." And after "proposals" before the comma, insert "meet the requirements" in paragraph A. And then Ms. White.
Mr. Chair, page 1, line 24, after the period, insert "if the department determines that an adequate vendor cannot be chosen based on the response to the request for proposals, the department shall report back to the chairs prior to the January 31st, 2012 contract date." And I can get that.
Okay. Is that... people understand what the... It's a complicated oral amendment. It's language. Senator Sharon.
And do I understand that we... I don't remember that we actually changed that date, so if that could be included in this amendment.
We did it.
I think we did that as an author's amendment.
Oh, good.
So we have changed the date, and we've... Is there any confusion about the language change that we're being offered here? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we could have the last portion of the amendment read louder and slower, please.
All right.
Ms. White. The last portion.
The last line, it would be following the period on line 1.24. Ms. White.
If the department determines that an adequate vendor cannot be chosen based on the response to the request for proposals, the department shall report back to the chairs of the committees having jurisdiction over this issue prior to the January 31st, 2012 contract date.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Everybody understand what we're doing here? And, Sir Sharon, is that a friendly amendment to you? All right. On the oral amendment to change... I'm sorry, Senator Lurie.
Mr. Chair, usually when we do that, we do say chairs and ranking minority members. I mean, just...
Very good. We'll take that as a friendly amendment to the amendment and incorporate that into the motion that Senator Higgins is making on changing the language. And does Council have that?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right. On the amendment, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
And I'd just also like to request that when the fiscal note is done on this bill, that the members of the committee receive it. And any other fiscal notes that are being worked on and changed, that we've heard bills, that we get copies of those also.
I would second that motion, Senator Berglund. So just as we get fiscal notes on these bills that we're considering, please get them to the committee. We will get them distributed to members. Senator Sharon.
And may I add to that request, a clarification about the concept of using federal dollars and whether or not the proposal, which we have done for energy assistance, you know, for improvements in conservation to businesses, for energy, the energy company has paid back the prices, the cost of the changes in the savings to the energy bill. That's the concept that's here create a solution for the state's share.
Very good. Thank you. Other questions? I know we've got a couple other people on our list that wanted to present some testimony to the bill. Why don't we hear from other people who are here to speak to the bill?
I'm an editor. In judiciary.
Mr. Searle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Noel Searle, Vice President, Second Harvest Heartland.
we support this bill, the direction this bill takes. In addition to operating a food bank and serving the charitable sector, we also look at the public side of the social safety net, particularly around hunger, and try to work so that both pieces become a seamless set of social support for those who need assistance with food. And part, and in major part because charity alone cannot do what needs to be done, in, particularly in times like these. We are a partner with DHS in the outreach effort to inform people of their eligibility and to help them when they go to fill out their application for food support. We also have outreach workers because we serve 18 counties of western Wisconsin. So we have the on-the-ground experience of working both with the online system in Wisconsin and the paper system in Minnesota. And I can tell you that our outreach workers find it takes half the time to help someone through the application in Wisconsin than it takes in Minnesota. We do this. We do the outreach as part of a federal-state nonprofit partnership. We put our own money into that effort. We have 11 outreach workers in metro and greater Minnesota counties. It is expensive and time-consuming for us and also for the clients. So we support the move, the direction that this legislation takes because we think it is in the best interest of scarce nonprofit resources. It is in the best interest of scarce county resources. And it certainly is in the best interest of the clients who need the assistance and find life difficult enough as it is, much less to spend hours working their way through a complex and increasingly obsolete system of paper documents. We interact with our fellow nonprofits from around the country, including the states that of Florida and Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, which are already leaders in this change. So we strongly support the direction that this bill takes.
Thank you, Mr. Newell. Mr. Searle, any questions? Mr. Searle. Thank you for your support. And is there someone else from Second Harvest that was here? No. Getting a no. All right. We do have one other person who's indicated wishing to present on the bill, Ms. Fitzsimmons.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Alexandra Fitzsimmons, and I'm the Legislative Affairs and Advocacy Director for Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. As many of you know, Children's Defense Fund is a research, outreach, education, and advocacy organization that works for the well-being of all children in Minnesota. So I'm here today to speak in support of and briefly address the importance of simplifying and streamlining our state's public programs and creating an online eligibility and application tool. As many of you know, too, this is one of the broad recommendations that came out of the Bipartisan Legislative Commission to End Poverty, and that commission specifically looked at how, as a state, we can end poverty over the next 10 years in Minnesota. Many Minnesotans live in households whose earnings are not enough to get by. 39% of Minnesota jobs, or approximately 1 million jobs, pay less than a living wage. In 2009, 174,000 children were living in poverty. This is a 53% increase from 2000. And an additional 115,000 children are living at 150% of the poverty level, which is approximately $33,000 for a family of four. Research shows the importance and the relationship between family income and child development. We know that economic insecurity can impede a child's development and his or her ability to succeed. This is one of the reasons why access to support programs is so important to low-income working families. Minnesota's public work support programs exist to help families move to economic self-sufficiency. However, and importantly, none of the public work support programs in Minnesota are fully utilized. For example, only 18% of Minnesota families who are eligible for the Working Family Credit or the Earned Income Tax Credit are receiving these credits. Similarly, that number is 20% in the WIC program, 22% in the Minnesota Care program, 28% in the School Meal program, 41% in the food support program, 70% in the energy assistance program, and 76% in the child care assistance program. Because these programs are so complicated, and as Senator Sharon shared at the beginning with Senator Benson's experience, many families are unable to successfully enroll in these programs. So simplifying programs, streamlining eligibility, and implementing this web-based application tool will ultimately help more families obtain these needed work supports, which will in turn help families meet basic needs and avoid hardship. As a result, children will have better health and well-being, more stable child care, and more positive outcomes, and parents will have greater success in employment in the long term. The last piece that I'd like to share with you is about 10 years ago, Children's Defense Fund started a project called Bridge to Benefits. Bridge to Benefits is a free online screening tool that is being used by community partners throughout Minnesota to screen potentially eligible families for work support programs and connect them to these needed services. Last year, Bridge to Benefits screened nearly 17,000 families, which included 44,000 family members. The average income of screened families last year was a little bit under $22,000, which, of course, is the federal poverty level at 100%. 94% of families were eligible and interested in at least one program. This year, Bridge to Benefits is on track to screen at least 30,000 families and approximately 100,000 family members. And just on a side note, too, I just want to point out that Children's Defense Fund does not accept or take any public funds. So simplifying, streamlining, and then implementing a web-based eligibility and application tool will put many more children and families on the path to economic security and well-being. Thank you so much for doing this bill.
Thank you, Mrs. Simmons. Any questions for the witness? All right. Well, thank you. And Senator Sharon, Senator Berglund?
Just one last comment about the fiscal note. If somebody has figured out a way that we can take savings to the county and use it for our state share, I sure would like to know about it. And if the idea is that the only program on this list that I'm aware of where the state actually does intake is Minnesota Care. And I'm certainly not going to be very happy if Minnesota Care is providing the entire state share for this myriad of programs, especially since Minnesota Care is having trouble with its own financing.
All right. Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Senator. I don't know if it's possible, but the concept that is being presented to Senator Benson is one in which federal dollars are collected, and then for the state's responsibility that the company itself, if it's allowed, will upfront those costs, and then if they're able to figure out a way in which they've created savings, that they would take that, they're willing to take that risk. They believe that the capacity to demonstrate cost savings is there. So we just have to figure out whether or not that's a workable formula, so that in the deficit we don't have to raise the revenue in order to meet the state share. Right. So with that, I'll renew my motion to lay this on the table for possible consideration.
All right. And I don't know if we have to vote on that. I think we can just lay it over and consider it for inclusion. But thank you for being willing to stand in for Senator Benson, and we appreciate you bringing the bill. Thank you. We're just going to put it on the list. Senator Berglund, are you ready to do 351? I think we'll just go down the list. We'll do mine last, and since we were a little bit delayed getting started. So.
Thank you, Senator Mr. Berger. Chairman, and members of the committee. Senate File 351 is a bill that is intended to try to speed up some of the savings that we should be getting otherwise out of health care reform, payment restructuring, and it creates a performance target for our managed care plans and county-based purchasing plans in the medical assistance and Minnesota Care programs to reduce rehospitalizations. That would be hospitalization for the same condition that would happen within 30 days of a previous hospitalization. It sets as a performance target for the plans a 5% withhold to be returned to each managed care organization that meets this reduced hospitalization rate. And, of course, if they don't, then we would keep the withhold, and that's one of the ways you guarantee savings in the fiscal note. I do have an amendment that I was asked by the Hospital Association to offer, and I think I maybe forgot to bring it up to the table with me, so maybe... I think
Senator Berglund, they're distributing the amendment here. So let's give members a chance to take a look at it.
And this would be an author's amendment.
All right.
The gist of the amendment is for the hospitals and the health plans to be able to get the encounter data that the department is collecting so that they would have a baseline to know how they're doing in regard to this issue, so they'd be able to measure themselves, and in discussions with the health plans that they're in contract with, they would know whether they're meeting the goal or not. And because I'm sure if they aren't, the health plans would want to pass along the penalty to the hospitals. And okay. So it just allows the Department of Health to be able to provide data that they are collecting on the encounters that are happening in the hospitals.
Right.
And it provides that the requester of the data, whether it would be a health plan on behalf of a hospital or a hospital directly, would be paying for the cost of getting that data from the Department of Health.
Mr. Chair?
Sir Marty.
Just a question. I'm not sure if the wording is right here. It reads the data submitted under paragraph A to carry provisions. I assume it means to carry out provisions. I'm not sure what the intent is, and maybe Senate Counsel could.
Senate Counsel, it's line 1.17 carrying down to 1.18. Sir Marty is.
Should we not be deleting the word out, I'm wondering?
We're getting a nod that says that's true, so before we adopt.
I'll incorporate that into the
right,
amendment.
Restore the word out on page 1, or line 1.17. Senator Berglund offers the, as an author's amendment, the A1. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted, and you have the bill in the form you wish.
Right. And so you can see the fiscal note. One of the reasons the savings are smaller in the beginning is because the contracts are not issued until January. So we don't get savings that we might have had starting in July. But then you can see there are respectable savings in the following years.
Right.
And, Mr. Chairman, I might just add that I believe these are very modest targets. We have a much higher rate of rehospitalization than a lot of other states, including our neighboring state of Wisconsin. And even if we meet these targets, we would still be higher than they are.
Okay. Questions for Senator Berglund? Is there anyone who wishes to testify on the bill? Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to read the sentence that starts on 3.26, and I'm struggling with what it actually says. So could somebody tell me what this sentence is supposed to say? Because it's not entirely obvious to me, which is kind of the way legislation is often, but...
Mr. Chairman and Senator Higgins, This is not to be a one-time proposition. It is to be a continuing withhold and target. So it'd be like 5% the first year, then another 5%, and then another 5% until you reach the 25% threshold. And that's what this paragraph is describing.
And so, Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, so is this only for enrollees for calendar year 2010? I guess that's the part that I've been getting hung up in is, you know, the phrase at the very end.
2010 is the base year we're measuring off of?
That's the base year. And, okay, and so...
So you start, you say this is what our rehospitalization rate is in 2010. And the goal is... over a number of years to reduce it by 25%.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Compared to that base year.
Compared to the base year.
I see. Okay. Does that...
And it's using the enrollees from 2010.
Right.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Other questions for Senator Berglund? Other questions? And there is a fiscal note, members, that shows some savings to this. My intent would be to lay this over to consider for inclusion in the bill.
I would so move.
All right. Thank you. And we will lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you. Senator Sharon, are you willing to take up 726 at this point? Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity to present on Senate File 726. Is that the right number?
726.
726. Thank you. I have an author's amendment that I make to offer right away.
We're going to get that distributed here, so please describe what your author's amendment will do, and we'll get it adopted.
In the original bill, an effort was being made to extend the offsets and asset limits of the medical assistance employment for persons with disability past the age of 65. But the fiscal note, in order to allow that to happen, was just overwhelming. There is a fiscal note on this bill with this amendment. So what you're seeing is a fiscal note takes into account the amendment, which changes what we're doing here from extending MAEPD to creating a different set of offsets for persons who have been on MAEPD when they reach the age of 65 and move from that program to medical assistance.
Okay.
And if we accept this amendment, I can walk through that.
Okay. Members, Senator Sharon offers the A4 as an author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Amendment is adopted, and you have the bill in the form you would like to see it, Senator Sharon.
Thank you. In your packet, I think it's the very last page, and Amy, if you would bring me a copy. I did not bring up a copy of the handout. So there is a handout that looks like that. And I put that together because the language is complex about these various programs. I think there's a second page to this, Amy. If you would pull that out, that might help us walk through what it is that we're talking about. I'd also like to invite Ann Henry, who is an attorney with the Minnesota Disability Law Center, to join me at the table, because she certainly is well versed on the details of these programs and their implications for the disabled.
I just saw that.
So it's, in essence, now what we're doing is creating a new income and asset disregard for certain MAEPT enrollees and transitioning to the standard medical assistance program at the age of 65. And the asset disregard that I'm proposing would allow enrollees who have enrolled in MAEPD, that's the medical assistance for employed persons with disabilities, during the 2 years, 24 consecutive months prior to reaching the age of 65, can retain assets, those earnings that they have had during the time of employment, and sustain the asset limit that was allowed under the medical assistance EPD asset limit of $20,000 as opposed to $3,000. The handout that I have, it was my effort to explain to myself what I'm doing, and so I thought it might be helpful to you. So what the handout does, if, with your permission, is I'll walk you through what MAEPD is, what it offers, what its benefits are, what happens if you are still disabled, which you will be if you're on MAEPD and turn 65, which, by the way, is a problem that we need to address much more comprehensively, which is the aging population of the disability community. So if for persons that I'm talking about who are on MAEPD, have been on this program for a while, and in order to meet to qualify for what I'm proposing, they have to have been on it for 24 consecutive months before they turn 65. But the program, the essential program of MAEPD, the person, in order to qualify for it, has to be at least 16 and under the age of 65. They have to be disabled, and in order to be determined disabled according to the language of the Social Security program, so they will have had that determination made. They have to pay premium. So this program, MAEPD, has a premium and other obligations or assessments that are based on gross earning and unearned income and family size. And this premium is adjusted based on federal poverty guidelines on an annual basis. By the way, the governor in his budget doubled this premium. The person has to earn at least $65, and they have to pay 0.5% of their Social Security income to DHS to be eligible. And in the governor's current budget, he proposes to increase the unearned income contribution tenfold to 5%. So it's a substantial increase. The benefit of this MAEPD program, why we've had an interest and why we introduced this, is because the person receives a medical assistance benefit set, waivered services, and PCA services, as opposed to moving the persons into an acute care setting or into a nursing home under Medicare, which, by the way, is time limited. They can save money through a 401k plan for long-term health care needs under the EPD program. They can keep the money that they've earned, up to $20,000, to meet such needs as their home maintenance costs, taxes on their home, other expenses, re-roofing their home if they need to, and can stay within their home. They're treated as a single household, which means no spousal income is considered. The benefits that come with this program is that people are working, and they not only share in the benefits of working, but the state shares in the benefits of having people work and making contribution through their taxes. They avoid more expensive care, and the spouse and family can avoid forced poverty. Under MA without EPD, as compared to MAEPD, so if we did nothing and the person turned 65 and moved over to MA, what would happen is that they would now move, as opposed to a $20,000 asset limit. It's a $20,000 asset limit, and then there's a premium paid based on income. The asset limit would drop to $3,000 as opposed to the $20,000. The MA income limit is either 100% of the federal poverty level, about $908 a month, and if it's even a dollar more than that, they immediately have to meet a 75% of poverty level, which drops down the monthly income to about $681. And they have to pay 0.5% of Social Security income to DHS. Under MA, no savings are allowed, no 401k, et cetera, if the asset is above $3,000, as opposed to allowing that under MAEPD. So what I'm proposing that we do is reform, make certain reforms that to prevent certain things from happening to people when they turn 65. As you can see, if you turn the page over, what happens after 65 without the changes that I'm proposing in this bill is that the income from Social Security and pension earnings must be spent down to 75% of poverty, over 100% of the federal poverty guideline. This includes the whole family incomes instead of just the single family being treated as a single person's income. So now the whole family's income is calculated as the person enters MA. People are forced to apply for other programs that they are not on if they're on MAEPD to cover their basic costs, such as food stamps, energy assistance, housing assistance, medical transportation. Their assets have to reduce to $3,000 for a single person, and if their spouse is living with them, to $6,000. So this reform, what is proposed in this bill, allows the spouse to keep their income to pay so that continues to be treated as a single household. So the spouse is able to keep their income to pay their household expenses. This is what I was talking about the other day, Senator Newman, about losing their home. They lose their home because they can't afford to pay the costs associated with maintaining the home. They don't necessarily lose the home, but they can't maintain the home. And if they don't have to spend down to poverty level, they could, if they spend down to poverty level, it threatens their capacity to maintain their living situation. It keeps the family from less desirable solutions, such as divorce, that Senator Berglund was mentioning the other day, that often is considered by people. And I don't know how often that is. In that discussion, we were trying to figure out how often that is. I can tell you that it's happening, that conversation is happening in our county for persons who are on reaching 65. And a person is concerned about protecting their spouse's income so that they don't have to be driven into poverty. Keeps persons out of more expensive hospital or long-term care and allows for the savings plans to help defer long-term care costs in the future after their income becomes limited. So I'll step away from this and let Ms. Henry speak to this issue, as she represents a large group of people in our state that are interested in this reform. But before saying that, I will just tell you the context out of which I was been drawn into this is a pastor in my community, and I've told many of you about him before. He has ALS, and he is really restricted to a wheelchair. He's on a ventilator, and he stays in his home with his spouse with PCA services, and he is on something called a CAC waiver. It's the kind of waiver that is given to people that not only are eligible for nursing home level care, but for hospital level of care. This is a person who would bypass nursing home level of care and go into the hospital. And without this change, that's with the spend downs that will have to occur, because it's now a family income is included in ME, it won't be long before this person is in the hospital. So I want you to think about just having this one person in the hospital being cared for will eat up in a very short period of time the money on an annual basis that's identified in the fiscal note. I think it's $53,000 in the first year and then drops down to $42,000. It's thousands, right? Mm-hmm. That is nothing compared to what this one of these people will be expending if they are moved over to MA, have their assets reduced, eventually move into poverty. The spouse simply won't be able to maintain the person in the home, and they'll be in the hospital. So with that, with your permission, I will turn it over to Ms. Henry.
Ms. Henry.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Ann Henry, and I'm with the Minnesota Disability Law Center at the Legal Aid Society. We are in strong support of Senator Sharon's bill. Of course, we agree that what would be ideal is to extend the opportunity to benefit from your work beyond the age of 65, but we know that's not possible to do right now. Let me just step back a minute and let you know that the Medical Assistance for Employed Persons with Disabilities program began as a state option in the Medicaid program as a work incentive because it was very clear that people who were disabled had to spend everything if they needed help at home. They couldn't get that help at home even if they had private coverage because private coverage doesn't pay, say, for a personal care assistant. If they qualified as disabled, say they had a work history and then they had an auto accident and had a brain injury, they would qualify for Social Security disability, and so they'd get a monthly benefit payment. They would also qualify for Medicare after 2 years, but Medicare also doesn't cover ongoing help at home should you become disabled. So folks in this situation were just really left with no other option but to impoverish themselves down to usually 75% of the poverty level because Social Security disability check is going to usually be more than 100% of the poverty level. And that really just completely wreaked havoc on people's lives. And yes, indeed, we have clients who have gotten divorced in this situation. You can't say it's all financial, but the financial pressures are really there, and they don't want to see either, you know, their children, their spouse, completely crushed into poverty as well. So the Senator Sharon's bill in Section 1 would allow people who have participated and worked in MAEPD prior to age 65 to at least keep the benefit of the savings they were able to accrue during that period of time. And with that money, then they could extend their independence for a bit longer. And also, as Senator Sharon explained, for those who have spouses, it would allow them to continue to work and manage all the other expenses. So we are in strong support of this bill, and we hope that you support it. We know it is an extremely tough year, and it does have a fiscal note. But we think if only we could do a fiscal note that would get the savings from someone not using food stamps, not using energy assistance, not using transportation, not using public housing, this fiscal note would look very different. It's just a tragedy that we can't look broadly at what happens in costs for people, that we're stuck just on medical assistance and not everything else that happens. But unfortunately, that's where we are right now. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Henry. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Henry, I strongly agree with your point about the fiscal note stuff. When we've been talking about dynamic scoring, tax fiscal notes, the same thing is true in this as well. Because we can't measure it well, we put fiscal notes in things that save money that make it look like they cost money, and it's a big mistake. And I strongly support this bill. I was going to say I think the whole MAEPD program still is not sufficient to help people. I was speaking to a group of young interns at the Capitol who are people with disabilities, and I asked them about how many of them had been limited the amount of income they can earn and still stay on the program. And I usually start a question like that, how many of you know people? And several of them volunteer. I personally am in that situation. I think out of 11 people, there are like five who are personally cannot work more, cannot earn more, cannot whatever, because otherwise they will bump out of the program. And that's the most foolish thing we can be doing when people want to work and they're able to work. And we don't let them work because they'll lose their health care if they do. And so I strongly support the bill. I think we desperately need to go further than this.
Thank you. Senator Sharon, is there someone else you wanted to testify?
Yes, Senator Han. I would like to introduce the committee to Roseanne Severns, who is here to give a face to the situation and explain how this impacts a real life.
All right. Welcome to our committee, and it's Roseanne. Could you
Severns? Yeah.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roseanne Severance. I live in Minneapolis. I am now 67 years old, and I have a master's degree. I benefited from MAEPD when I was younger and under age 65. I had a job at the University of Minnesota and had health care insurance through my employer. But because I needed a personal care attendant to help me in and out of bed, I needed to qualify for medical assistance too. because private coverage doesn't cover personal care attendant services. I paid my MAEPD premiums and the rest of my costs from my income. I also saved for retirement. I was devastated to learn that at age 65, I could no longer participate in the MAEPD program. Instead, I had to qualify for regular MA, which meant I had to spend all my income on my health care bills down to $677 per month. In fact, I was given 1 month to spend my retirement savings or those funds which would have gone to help pay health care, too. I used my retirement funds to buy items and supplies I would need for upcoming months and years, knowing that I wouldn't have enough to live on. I did give a list of these items and receipts to medical assistants so they are well aware of where the money went and how it was spent. I get Social Security, which I paid into during my working years. I now have to pay $1,849 of my Social Security each month, that's each month, for my medical assistance costs because I need PCA services. Medicare does not cover PCA services, just like my employer-based health care coverage did not. This leaves me with $677 per month to live on. It has been extremely difficult to go from being quite independent and needing numerous public assistance programs. I have subsidized housing. I have had to apply for food assistance. I also have applied for energy assistance because I need oxygen at night, and that takes electricity. I need transportation help now because I can't afford to use my van that I drive myself, the modified van that I bought while I was working. Though this bill does not extend MAEPD beyond age 65 for those who can continue to be employed, the bill would have helped me and should be passed so others don't have to go through what I have had to go through and still am. It helps to allow persons with disabilities who worked under MAEPD to maintain their savings after age 65. I could have stayed financially independent longer because I could have used my retirement savings to pay my expenses instead of having to spend it in 1 month. I bought needed items, medical supplies, paper products, and other supplies, but I had to get food stamps, energy assistance, and needed transportation help instead of using my money for expenses at this time. It is important to allow people with disabilities who work before age 65 to keep their savings after 65. We want to be independent as possible, allowing people to keep their savings, and not counting a spouse's income after 65 would allow more people with disabilities who worked and saved to keep their families together, maintain their homes, and pay their way longer. I also continue to work at the Guthrie Theater. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you for being here this morning. Appreciate your testimony. Are there questions for Senator Sharon or the witnesses? Senator Sharon, I thank you for your work on this bill and for bringing it forward. I appreciate the effort and certainly the creative way of trying to solve a problem that we're being confronted with. So thank you for that.
I appreciate that. I'll just close by saying I know that Even this small, I think this is a small fiscal note compared to what we're going to get for it, that it might be difficult, but I'm hoping that as we look at how to put together our and meet our target, that we really grasp that the
just to be sure they know what's on the amendment.
Yeah, that we really grasp that it's nothing compared to what we're going to be billed for services from some really severely disabled people who are staying out of that high-cost care because of this.
Right.
And I just would remind you, Ms. Henry asked me to remind you that the fiscal note is based on the amendment. That it does not include the extension of MAEPD. It's based
Thank
on
you.
The amendment.
So Appreciate
I would make the motion to lay this. Is that your preference to lay it on the table?
Yes.
For consideration in the
Senator Hoffman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a quick question. Do you know about Senator Sharon about how many people in Minnesota are affected by this?
I do.
Senator Sharon,
I asked that question. It's about 30 persons a year
who would turn
65. So it would be
okay.
Each year.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, and it is my intention to lay this over to consider for inclusion. I appreciate your work on this and bringing it forward, and. Thank you for doing that. Thank you.
Don't we already have this? Okay, Senator Hans.
Madam Chair, members, we'll take up 703, Senate File 703, which is a proposal that was brought to me by the counties. And I understand there is an amendment. I don't have it, I guess, in my packet here. Thank you.
It's being passed out right now, Senator.
All right. And this is a delete everything amendment. I have not seen this before this morning, so I'm going to ask that the committee adopt the A1 amendment, and then we'll ask our testifiers to talk us through what we're doing here. So
okay.
I move A1 amendment.
Author's amendment. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as I said, I have not seen the amendment until just now, so I'm going to turn it over to our testifiers and ask if they would talk about the bill and what the amendment does now that it's in that form. And
very good.
All right.
Please.
I'll jump in. Good morning.
Thank you. Please state your name.
Yep. I am Paul Fleissner, Chair Rosen, and Senators. I am representing the Association of Minnesota Counties, the Minnesota Inter-County Association, and the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators. I'm the Director of Community Services for Olmsted County. And I guess building on the testimony earlier of simplification, I suppose it would have been inappropriate for me to say hallelujah. But like Senator Berglund, I've been promoting simplification and modernization of our systems for a long time. As I said at the House earlier this week, I feel a bit like I'm on a quest, but my success has been about as successful as the Knights of Knee from Monty Python. So I'm hoping that this year we get something done. I have passed out to you a sheet, and it's at the top of it, it says FEOC. So if you pull that out, that particular document is actually from 2006 when I was working on simplification. It's a listing of all the things in our system, our public assistance eligibility system, that we have to do by hand, workarounds, because we still have a green screen DOS-based system. DHS can't even hire people to fix the system. As we heard earlier, there are options out there. But in this particular environment, where we've got killing people here? Okay.
So, Fleissner, we have to hold on a second. We're looking for this handout. Is there a handout, you said?
Mm-hmm. It says FIAT.
Oh, that one.
At the top.
Okay. Thank you.
And
they'll have it.
None of the language within it will mean anything to you, but each one of those items are things that financial workers have to do hand workarounds, which leads to delays, errors, and we heard there's a better way here. If you may recall, the Minnesota Healthcare Connect study a few years ago said we have the third most complicated system in the state for eligibility, with something like 26 programs and 16,000 decision points. When you add in the fact that it's not modernized, we have a real issue. On top of that, we look at our economy, and in Olmsted County, where I work, we've had a growth in our caseloads from 2007 to now of over 2,000 cases, or over 20%. And that does not include how many people apply. Those are the folks that were eligible. So we're drowning, and we don't have the tools to support people who are coming in and applying. So that's why I'm very excited, not only about our bill, but the bill I heard about earlier. We've done a lot of things in our county, everything from business process mapping, workflow fixes, case banking, processes that try to streamline what we do to keep up because we haven't added staff. In fact, I've in my department, I've got 10% less staff than I had in 2003. So we need to find the tools to provide a system of eligibility that works in our state. So I would advocate that we continue to work toward simplifying, streamlining, and modernizing. Now I'll turn it over to my colleague, Judith, who will walk you through the bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Pleiser. Welcome, Ms. Broomfield.
Members of the committee, my name is Judith Broomfield, and I'm the Deputy Director of Health and Human Services in Scott County. Like Mr. Fleischer, I'm representing the Association of Minnesota Counties, the Metropolitan Inter-County Association, and the Association of Minnesota Social Service Administrators. I want to walk you through just quickly the various sections of this bill and explain why it's important to counties, as well as probably more important to the people we serve. But walking through section by section, just to let you know, the 1A amendment that you adopted this morning is primarily technical changes to some of the language in what was formerly sections 5 through 8. And more importantly, some changes to formerly Section 1, 3, and 9. In working with the Department of Human Services, we recognized there were some things that could be done immediately and some things that would be longer term. So we have amended the bill somewhat to take those into consideration. The experience of all counties would be somewhat different but very similar, depending upon the characteristics of their population, the general theme of all these counties would be the examples that I will give you as I walk through this bill. For example, Ramsey County public assistance caseloads have grown by more than 8,000 cases in the last 2 years, very similar to what Mr. Fleischner talked about in Olmsted County. In Scott County, we found a 44% increase in our caseloads in the last 4 years. This is not primarily family assistance caseloads. Rather, it's medical assistance and food support. This is a direct result of the recession in our economy, and the need for public services really lags the recovery, so that we're beginning now to see the big bulk of people who are needing assistance as they have exhausted all other options for themselves. County staff are often managing caseloads of over 500 individuals or families. This allows very little time for the accuracy that we know we need in these programs, as well as for timely response to people who are in desperate situations. Counties have made a number of changes, as Mr. Fleischner talked about, to increase our efficiency, including investing in technology in every area that we can. But because a number of these programs are statewide programs based on systems that are housed at the state, there's limited ability that counties have, and I think we've exhausted what we can do at the county level. The importance of this bill really is to help assure a more accurate and efficient operation at the county level. Now let me walk just briefly through each of the sections and tell you what they mean and why they're important. Section 1 in the 1A, or the A1 amendment, is a computer system simplification. There are two portions of this. One is in the child support. Currently, when child support is collected for families on public assistance, that child support is sent to the family, then it needs to be basically credited back to their MFIP grant, their public assistance grant. This is a manual process right now. The county is notified of the child support payment, but then the financial worker needs to go into the system and manually enter that amount to credit it against the grant. So what this provision would allow is for that to be automatically credited against their grant amount, saving that manual step for the county staff. This represents a significant savings. I believe Ramsey County estimated up to 3 FTEs are utilized to do that particular program. The second part of this particular section has to do with the MMIS billing format. This is the Minnesota Medicaid Information System. Several years ago, when a number of the programs were moved to health plans, the elderly waiver, and the mental health case management, those health plans generally contracted the services back with counties. This moved the payment system off of the MMIS system, and each health plan has their own payment billing system at this point in time. So counties are needing to utilize from 2 to 5 different billing formats in order to get paid from medical assistance for their services. This would ask that each of the health plans be required to accept the MMIS billing format so the counties would be able to use one billing format rather than 2 to 5 different formats.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Higgins.
Ms. Brumfield, would you please pull your microphone closer? I'm with the door opening and closing. Yet again, I'm having trouble hearing. So.
I apologize. Realizing that Mr. Fleischman was blowing everyone out, I moved a little further away. So
just bring it up like you think you're a rock star.
Okay.
Just bring it up close.
Ms. Brumfield.
Closer.
Madam Chair, I'll do my best.
Thank you.
Okay, Section 2 is the provision of required materials in alternative formats. Again, there are some federal requirements to this, but each county is required for anyone who is applying for and eligible for health care, public health care, to send out information packets from each of the health plans that they might be eligible for. So in counties, again, that could be from 2 to 6 health plans that they need to send out information. Those health plan packets, you've gotten them from your own health care provider, often this thick. So the cost to counties for each packet they send out is generally between $5 and $8. Most of our clients say that isn't helpful information to them, that first of all they'd rather get it in a different format and they'd rather have a simplified format and then be able to ask for additional information if they want. So Section 2 is fairly lengthy, but it really does say let's look at a different format, being able to send out a simplified form to the applicants and then let them have an option for getting greater information for any health plan they're particularly interested in. We do recognize that this is a federal requirement, that it would require that there has to be some assurance that people have access to all the information, but we're looking for a simplified and less expensive way, which will be a benefit to both counties as well as the health plans. Sections 3 through 6 are covering a number of different programs, but it deals with the recovery of overpayments. Currently, each different program has a different schedule for a look back for overpayments and how those are calculated. So it means the financial workers have to keep track of all the different programs depending upon where the overpayment is. It leads to a high error rate, very time-consuming to try and create the overpayment for each of these various programs. So this is simplifying these sections by saying let's have a single type of criteria for overpayment and make them all the same. Section 7 is county electronic verification procedures, and this moves into the revised Sections 1, 3, and 7. Section 7 asks that the department help design, at this point in time, all of the existing databases for electronic verification. This would include birth certificates, employment records, all the ones that we need for eligibility that are currently available, and make those accessible to counties to do our verifications that way. That's very helpful to the people applying for assistance who don't have to bring in a number of paper verifications that counties copy and put in the case records. So it would be very helpful to the consumers as well as streamlining and saving time for counties. Section 8 is the other part of that, and the larger part, which is to align the program so that we have the same criteria for each of the programs. We have a very complicated system, and that was part of what Mr. Fleischer handed out to you. The number of different programs, all of whom ask for different kinds of verification and different eligibility requirements. So this is a longer-term look by the state at the various programs and which ones can we align to have similar verifications to make a simplified system, which certainly would move the state toward what we all talked about earlier today, which is a more of an online application system. Then the final section, Section 9, looks at some alternative strategies for certain redeterminations. Several years ago, Hennepin County developed a pilot project working with the Department of Human Services to see a particular population that do not have many changes in their eligibility factors. Someone who is disabled with a lifetime disability does not tend to have a lot of changes in their benefits over time, and yet they go through the same extensive redetermination process as the working family who may have moved into employment and have great changes in their income. So what Hennepin County has been trying to do is look at a simplified redetermination form for that population. Section 9 asks that we expand the population to those people who do not have changes in their income and eligibility over time, and a simplified process for that group of people. That certainly would be administrative simplification for counties, but again, it would be a massive benefit for those people who go through a very cumbersome redetermination process on a regular basis for no change in income or assets. In summary, all of these sections of the bill are intended to reduce the complexity leading to a streamlining of programs that will result really in expanded capacity for service on the part of counties to respond to the rising caseloads without our needing to increase staff, because no counties are increasing staff in this area, and that we should be able to provide a more cost-effective and better quality service to our citizens.
Thank you. Thank you. Broomfield, what is the, if you, you know, just briefly again, what is the difference between the original bill and the A1 amendment then?
Madam Chair, the differences between the original bill and the A1 amendment, some renumbering of sections, but basically a number of technical changes to previously sections 5 through 8. Okay. And because of the changes in numbering, those have now become, sections 3 through 6. Sections 1, 3, and 9 were combined, and that's where the changes occurred to really split that out into two programs, one that could be immediately implemented for assuring the electronic verification of those things that could be done now, and that is Section 7, and then Section 8 is the longer-term study of how to align the programs and then move to electronic verification.
Wonderful. Thank you. Senator Hill.
And Madam Chair, I would just like to confirm with someone who may know if the fiscal note that we have reflects the amendment as well as the original bill.
Mr. Albrecht?
Mr. Chair, I would think not, given that, to my knowledge, the department hasn't seen the amendment.
Senator Hahn, to me, as it was explained by Ms. Broomfield, there's just some technical changes, maneuvering some of the wordage around and combining some of the sections. So I would assume that the fiscal note would probably be the same as the original bill.
And Madam Chair, that was my assumption as well. I just wanted to make sure that that was correct and that we didn't do anything in the amendment that would have. Is there somebody in the department who can acknowledge that?
Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kate Wolf from the Department of Human Services. None of the changes in the amendment would affect the fiscal note.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wolf.
Madam Chair, and I don't know that I don't have anybody on the list who is wanting to testify in addition. I did want to at least ask the question. I know there's several references in the bill as amended referring to prepaid health plans activities, and I don't know if there's anybody here that may want to offer some comment on that from the prepaid health plans. I would certainly invite them to do so.
Good question, Senator Hahn. Anybody that would like to come up to the testifying table? Oh, we have no's in the audience, so Looks good.
Well, Madam Chair and members, my hope would be to lay this over to consider inclusion in the bill. I know there is a fiscal note to it reflecting, I think, essentially some changes in the computer system and some additional personnel costs. But I would like to at least consider that as we're putting our bill together.
Sure. Senator Birkeland.
Madam Chair, thank you. In reading through the fiscal note, I noticed that some of the larger costs are assumed to be covered by funding the counties would be contributing. And I just wanted to ask the counties if that is their assumption also. Because those costs don't show up on our fiscal note. There's an estimated $400,000.
Which page is that on, Senator Berglund?
It's on page 3 of the fiscal note, paragraph 3.
Mr. Fleiser?
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, the way I read this is we currently contribute some money towards SSIS fiscal operations, and the way I read it, it sounds like it would be included in part of what we already contribute. Is that how we need that? I'm not aware that they've asked us to increase that contribution, but we do have a contribution in place now.
Madam Chair, Ms. Senator Berglund. There is currently a formula that is used to support the fiscal portion of the SSIS program along with the non-child welfare funded portion of that. And that, so the county contribution does fluctuate based upon the cost of that. This fiscal note notes that that may affect the county contribution. And yes, as counties are asking for this, we have always approved the changes to that amount based on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome, Senator Berglund. Senator Newman, and then Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For either of the testifiers, if you go to page 3 on the amendment, line 3.6, it seems to indicate that except as what, and I don't know what that statute says, the county shall recover overpayments. Can you tell me what that addition means? Line 3.6.
Ms. Broomfield?
Madam Chair, Senator, I would have to look back at the statute to be absolutely accurate on this, but there are certain interim assistance areas where the recovery is very different, and we're saying we're not going to change that.
Senator Newman.
Thank you. If you wouldn't, I would request that you get back to the chair with an explanation on that. And then a very quick follow-up.
Senator Newman, before you move on, Ms. White has a response to that, I believe.
Madam Chair and Senator, the statute relates to the General Assistance Program, so maybe that would help you in answering your question.
Ms. Broomfield?
Madam Chair, I would rather get back. I'm not totally sure, so I would certainly get back to the chair.
That'd be wonderful. Thank you. Appreciate that. Yes, Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this bill, as I understand, is going to be laid over.
Laid over.
Providing us with the information after the fact is perfectly acceptable. And then very quickly, on the last page, we are repealing a subpart of a Minnesota rule. Perhaps you could include in your explanation what is that repealer and what are we doing there? Because I don't have the rules in front of me, so just a very brief explanation would be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Newman. Senator Higgins?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have just a collection of random things. On line 1.33,
It talks about materials are sent to a secured mailbox, and I'm thinking that maybe electronic should be in front of mailbox, if that's what we're talking about. I mean, because people my parents' age, a mailbox is that thing on the corner. So I think we should put electronic or email or something like that.
Senator Higgins, that was actually one of my questions is in this section they wanted to simplify and streamline the material that's going to go out. And that was kind of how are you going to do that? Is it going to be all electronically and you forget the paper trail and the paper mail? So that's a very good question.
And then on 1.24, I'm not sure that the two words that start that section are necessary. It talks about it may be provided in an alternative format if the following conditions are met. And then it says that the plan agency or whatever informs the enrollee that provision in an alternative format is available. I just think if you inform the enrollee that an alternative format is available is kind of what we're saying. And so I think those first two words could go away. And then I feel obligated to do the Dennis Fredrickson amendment. The Dennis Fredrickson Memorial Amendment would be on line 2.8, taking out the word such and inserting the word the. And then I've been working on 3.26 to 3.28. And I think what this says is that no more than 12 months of an overpayment must be recovered if the error was due to agency error, if the overpayment was due to agency error, and no more than 6 years, so 6 months or 6 years, if the overpayment was because of client error or an intentional violation. And I think if we could turn that around and make that a little more understandable, but I can't do it on the fly. I've been working at it and scratching out. And
Senator,
you
did teach English.
I'm a professional editor by trade.
Ms. White.
Madam Chair, first of all, secured mailbox is used in other statutes, so I don't know if you want to change that or not. And then the language that you're referring to is actually in about four sections.
Mm-hmm.
So, I can change it if you'd like. The department and the counties have looked at it and understand what it does. But if you want it changed, I can do that.
Madam Chair, I think if we could make it a little more clear, that would be a good thing to do. And if it needs to be done in multiple places, that would I think be useful. I think I understand that these statutes are probably used by people who really know this business, and so they know what it means. But if other people are trying to figure it out, it might be useful to have it in a little more plain, clear language.
Senator Hahn?
Maybe the best way to do this, Senator Higgins, if it's all right with you, is we'll lay this over and we'll ask counsel mm-hmm. to look at these things that you've noted and see if we can find some clearer language, if that's possible.
That'd be great.
And if we take it up again, we can review that at that point. But
that'd be great, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Or Senator Hahn, I guess you are at this table.
Whatever.
So, Senator Hahn, do you want to move some of the oral amendments and work on the language a little bit later?
Before we do that, I think Ms. Broomfield has an answer on the repealer, so let's hear from that.
Madam Chair, the question on Section 10, the repealer, this is a Minnesota rule that actually deals with the look back in rule of some of these other provisions. So once it goes into statute, you no longer need it in rule. So it's simply a repealer of what now would be obsolete language.
Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Bickle.
Madam Chair, I think as this is the first time I've looked at the amendment, I I understand what Senator Higgins is saying. I don't disagree. I think it might be better rather than try to amend those things on the fly here. Let's let council take a look at the words that we've got suggested and see if we can come up with some clear language. And we take it up again, we can, okay. If we take it up again,
okay.
Do it.
Super.
Again.
Thank you. Senator Berglund?
Madam Chair,
it's kind of how we do things.
So as things go along throughout the session, if the counties would not be able to make the contribution that is required in this bill, I would hope somebody would let us know so that we're not mandating that it happen.
Establishment of an overpayment? What the hell is that? Senator Hand.
Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, I would agree and support that. So I would hope as we go forward, if the counties do discover something here that is problematic, that they alert us to that so we'd have an opportunity to correct it.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Hunt, I'm just assuming that maybe they are going to be receiving a lot less state funding than they do today, and if that's going to affect their ability to make this contribution, we would want to know about it.
Yes. Ms. Broomfield or Mr. Fleissner, all of us have been talking to our counties, have had various meetings with them, asking for any help, any suggestions that can come to help alleviate, streamline the process, help you deliver your services better. And this is what has been agreed upon by the counties. Is this about the most aggressive that you could come up with, or do you have more in the back pocket that you're working on? Mr. Fleissner.
Chair Rosen and Senators, I think we're talking with all kinds of legislators about various kinds of bills coming through, not all that we created, including language around service delivery authorities and other things that that could lead to, I think, a new and better system. And I think we're interested in any ideas out there. I think this is one we were able to put together that all counties could agree with. I think the other bill we heard earlier is something that counties are excited but didn't necessarily generate. So the more simplification, we are drowning in our public assistance system. And certainly that's one target, but there are other systems that we'd be interested in looking at. But the dilemma we've got, as we serve more people and we don't know what the cuts are going to be, it's hard to zig and zag until we see where things get narrowed down. We obviously have lots of vulnerable populations that we serve. Over the last 8 years, as I know, in Olmsted County, we've had to narrow and narrow and focus on core services. I think it's going to be important for the discussion that what vulnerable populations does the state want us to serve and at what level? And, you know, anything we can do to simplify the system so we can maximize the resources we do have is critical, I think, to this discussion.
Yeah, very good. Ms. Broomfield, final comment?
Yes, Madam Chair. Certainly this is something that the counties brought forward that we believe will help us. Part of the framing that we have to do at this point in time is the same as the legislature is doing. We know there's not additional funding available, and many of the kinds of things that would really help all of us long-term are going to cost money. So we've tried to look at those things that are fairly cost-neutral or have a fairly low cost. The other very strong message, I think, coming from counties is as the legislature looks at what populations are not going to be served or where the funding cuts are going to be, that we no longer be required to do those things that the state is choosing to fund, to not fund in the future. So we have to pair both the mandates with the funding available and give counties flexibility to nimbly serve the populations as best we can. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Hand, would it be okay with you and the committee to just have Ms. White be able to work on that language? And then do you feel like it needs to come back, or can we just incorporate it into the language and take Senator Higgins' suggestions on the other two changes?
Madam Chair, that would be my hope, that the committee would be permissive of us to take a look at this language. If we do incorporate it in the bill, we'll try to address some of the concerns that Senator Higgins has raised, and we'll point those out when the bill is before the committee.
That'd be wonderful. Thank you. With that, I believe the motion is to lay it over for possible inclusion.
Madam Chair, I'd like to have this laid over for consideration.
Thank you, Senator Hand. Thank you, Ms. Broomfield and Ms. Fleissner. Mr. Fleissner. And with that, members, our next hearing is Monday at the normal time at 1 o'clock.
Meeting is adjourned.